Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be now and always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Would you please be seated? You lack one thing. Sell all you have, give the money to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. Come, follow me. Well, that's a bit awkward, isn't it? It's a bit embarrassing. It's a bit difficult. What are we to make of this? This awkward, difficult, challenging thing. Well, it's obviously a bit of a too much of a challenge for the college in general. I seem to have shied away from this one this evening. But here we are. We're going to wrestle with it. Of course, that is the usual thing. The usual thing is to ignore it. The usual thing is either to ignore it completely and just not set it as a text, or to explain it away in some extraordinary thing that somehow takes all the kind of pith and challenge and edge out of it. I can remember when I was a schoolboy and we were obliged, like it or lump it, every Sunday we trooped down to the parish church in the local village, which was the kind of village in which no actual farm labourer could possibly have afforded to live, but nevertheless liked to think of itself as a very pretty country village. And I remember this very text, the whole thing, including the rich man and the camel and the eye of the needle, even as the sun was glinting off the serried ranks of Mercedes and BMWs in the car park of this church. This very text came up, and I sat on the edge of my seat. I thought, oh, this is good, you know, what's he going to do here? And he said, of course, we must understand this text spiritually. We are all to be spiritually at the Lord's. And then this word, spiritually, and I was 14, and I came to the conclusion that the word spiritually must mean not really. Spiritually means just, you know. Anyway, I'm not going to fob you off with the word spiritually tonight. I'm going to try and wrestle with this. I'm going to try and think through with it. What makes it, of course, awkward and difficult is quite frankly that none of us have actually done it. Here we all are. We're all still have the clothes we've got, and we may, who knows, have some more clothes in cupboards at home and possibly more than one pair of shoes. Who knows, if you're like me, we may have quite a large number of books, which we promise not to keep buying more of, but nevertheless we do. And I don't know what the full range of your possessions are. I suppose those of us that are fellows and faculty may be more embarrassed by this text than you are as students, because, of course, having student loans, you could say that you had less than nothing, and that if you actually gave away the less than nothing that you have, you'd be quids in. You know, that if you could actually sell your debt, you'd be in a very... So perhaps you're not embarrassed by this text at all, but some of us are, so bear with me. So I try to think. So we could ignore it, but let's not do that. Here it is. It's staring us in the face every day. It's part of our culture, part of our gospel. What do we do with it? Well, we should perhaps begin by looking at what one of the most typical, most long-standing and traditional responses of the church over the centuries to this saying and similar ones has been. And that has been, historically, to make a distinction within the teachings of Jesus, to make a distinction between what are called the general commandments, on the one hand, and what are called the counsels of perfection, on the other. So the general commandments would be those big things that Jesus is clearly saying to absolutely everybody, as on Maundy Thursday, novum mandatum, a new commandment I give to you, therefore, that you should love one another as I have loved you. That's a general commandment laid on all of us, to live loving one another. Or the golden rule, that you should do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or Jesus' own summary, quoting directly from the Old Testament, of the two greatest commandments, the summary of the law, that you should love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength, and that you should love your neighbour as yourself. So the church has said those apply to everybody. But particularly from the Middle Ages onwards, the Catholic Church developed this distinction and said there are those, but then there are counsels of perfection. Now, the counsels of perfection are advice to individuals, particularly called people, about how to live a perfect life. They are, as it were, a kind of special paper for those looking for a start first in Christian life. Now, immediately, I hope your hackles are raising and your sense that this can't be quite right, that there's some kind of fudging going on here, raised. But that was the idea. And so that not only this passage about selling all you have, but actually some of the very Beatitudes themselves about blessed are the poor and blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, and all of that. These began to be, as it were, siphoned off into this special category known as counsels of perfections. They were, as it were, something for the saints, and something especially as the church developed and as monasticism arose, something that could be incorporated safely into the rules of the religious orders. So we could feel all right that the church somehow in general was obeying this command, because we had some good old Benedictines out there, you know, allegedly having given up everything, in some sense, almost vicariously for us. And it fed very uneasily into a kind of whole idea that somehow the priesthood, particularly at a time when the priesthood was also expected to be celibate, were sort of stepping up onto some kind of plinth and were living an especially extra holy life. So that was the stratagem, as it were, of the church for dealing with these sharp, difficult sayings of Jesus, that we should all generally keep the general commandments, and that the counsels of perfection were for people specially called. Well, if we were to accept this distinction, it would get us off the hook. We could say, this is a true saying of Jesus, it just is not addressed to me. What a relief. And then, of course, we're licensed to go through the rest of the gospel, and anything we find a bit uncomfortable, we can say, well, that's for someone else, and I'll concentrate on the bits that seem to be good for me, like the bit where he turns water into wine, that kind of thing. I'll stay with that, and I'll just hive off the rest. But I don't think, unfortunately, that we can, with any integrity, reading the whole of the New Testament, I don't think we can accept that distinction. First of all, Jesus never made that distinction himself. In fact, the very idea of a two-tier Christian life is inimical to the gospel, because the gospel is just full of all-including universals. He died for all are included, his love is for all, his word is to all. I think when we start saying there's one kind of Christian and another kind of Christian, there's a problem there. Further, if we say that certain people are required to do certain things and others required to do other or lesser things, then we have, even as we begin to think like that, we have fallen out of the gospel, the good news, of a freely given love and a freely accepted grace, and we have fallen back into the law, into the works of the law, into justification by the works of the law, into the idea that you have to do this, this, and this, and then eventually you might be acceptable, and if you can just take that extra paper and get it's all competitive, and you know, you'll get a better grade in heaven when you know. And that is, the gospel has nothing to do with that. He has concluded all under sin that he might have mercy on all. The Lord is near to all such as fall. It's the very opposite of all the things that Jesus is constantly doing when he's spending his time with the tax gatherers and the sinners. And even this young man, we're told straight away that Jesus loved this young man, and I want to come back to that. And he loved him when he perhaps knew already that he wasn't going to be able to do the very thing that was asked of him. So any sense that people are sort of having to take different tests and are justified by what they do seems to me have nothing to do with the gospel of the free grace of Jesus Christ, finding us where we are and saving us. This is love, not that we first loved him, but that he loved us and gave his life for us. So I think we can have nothing to do with that. And the historical effect of accepting that distinction was very bad. It's one of the reasons why we had the Reformation, that we had this idea that there were these sort of super Christians who were kind of acquiring extra merit, and then maybe if we're lucky, distributing it to other people. And everybody felt slightly browbeaten by that. You were never quite as good as your parish priest, and your parish priest was never quite as good as the Benedictines down the road. And then the Benedictines down the road who'd been sort of crowning themselves with the glory of being the best of Christians of all, so their great consternation suddenly found that the Franciscans coming up the road were even holier than they were, and they were got in great fusses with each other. We can't go there. It's just not in the spirit of the gospel at all. So if that distinction between general commandments and counsels of perfection won't do, what are we to make of this saying? Well, we're going to have to live with it, and we're going to have to live with it in a fruitful tension. We mustn't ignore it, and yet we mustn't pretend that we've fulfilled it. Of course, we can note that it is indeed, in the gospel context, a word to an individual, that he did ask this particular person to sell all he had. And there seems to be lots of others that he didn't ask that, when he went to the centurion's house, or when he went to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he didn't ask that. When Nicodemus, he called him that, when Zacchaeus was called down from the tree, the tax collector, he said, I'm having lunch with you. He didn't make any conditions at all. Zacchaeus freely said, I'm going to give away half of what I've got. And Jesus didn't say, where's the other 50% then? He seemed to have completely accepted and rejoiced in the move that Zacchaeus made. So we can certainly note that it is to an individual. There are others from whom he doesn't ask so much. But I don't think we can know exactly who the individuals are that he's asking of this, or be certain that he is not now asking, or may not at some future point, ask just that of us. We should also note that this so-called Council of Perfection, which the church wanted to hive off into a separate category, is in one clear and particular way fulfilling exactly the church's, the general command, love your neighbour as yourself. That is the fulfilling of the law. Love one another as I have loved you. How has he loved us? He's loved us to the very last. He gave everything until he had absolutely nothing. He had no place to hide his head. And in the end, the last thing that he had, even the robe on his back, was stripped off him. The nails pierced him. The spear pierced his heart. And he gave the very last of all he had, his life itself, his heart's blood for us. And that was love. Greater love hath no man than that he laid down his life for his friends. So if he says, love as a general commandment, now you should love each other as I have loved you, that doesn't exactly get us off the hook. It doesn't say you can have a slightly limited, less committed, cheaper way of loving. So you could say that in this particular case, for this young man, that selling all he had was just a particular way of fulfilling a general commandment. Indeed, it was a particular way of fulfilling all the things we've been hearing from the scripture this evening. We had it there in Psalm 82, deliver the outcast and the poor, we sang. We had it in Deuteronomy, give liberally, be open-handed, open your hand to the poor and the needy, to your neighbor in your land, said Deuteronomy. So even if we don't believe that we are personally called, like this young man, to give everything, to sell everything and give the money to the poor, this story still gives us a good reminder of the overarching principle that we are to be generous, that we are to be open-handed, that we are to give freely, that we are to sit lightly to the things that we have. And in fact, it might stand there in the gospel for us to provide us with a continuous sense of relief and holiday and joy that every time we do gladly and freely give and find that in spite of our generous giving, there is still a bottle of sherry in the cupboard and a chance of a glass in the evening, we might breathe a huge sigh of relief and say, well, thank you, Lord, I was able to be generous today and I still have something. So we might even see it as a way of measuring his generosity to us as well as ours to others. Further, we actually ought to note that this particular saying, sell all you have and give to the poor, seems to be an application, a nice practical application, of the general principle that we looked at last week. A fundamental principle in life, a psychologically true principle, whatever your faith. When Jesus said, he who grasps and holds on to his life will lose it, but he who loses his life will save it. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it bears no fruit. But if it dies, it yields much fruit. Otherwise, it dies singly and alone. We all know that there is a general principle in life that letting go somehow releases. Not only releases things for other people, but releases things for us. That the generous heart is often generously rewarded. That in some sense, the more we cling to possessions or cling to people as though they were possessions, the more those things kind of rust and go bad on us. But the more freely and generously we're able to be open-handed with them, the more, in fact, they seem to bless and not to burden us. So there seems to be some application there. Finally, I think we should look very carefully at this saying and try and understand it in the context or the frame of the other words of the gospel around it. We could spend ages, and indeed some people have written whole books, discussing this saying as if it was part of an effort to establish a big systematic list of universal Christian do's and don'ts that we can then have on our walls and tick off as we go through life. But that is not how it feels in the gospel. Look closely again at the passage as you have it, and you will see that it's not actually about abstract ethics. It's about a calling. It's about a following. It's about a loving relationship. This saying, sell all you have and give it to the poor, you will have treasure in heaven, come and follow me, is prefaced, well, sell all you have and give to this, prefaced by these words, Jesus looked at him and loved him. Prefaced by those words. And it's followed by the words, you will have treasure in heaven, come and follow me. In another place, Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. And this is a story of a young man trying and failing to give his heart to Jesus, who has indeed already given his heart. Jesus has given his heart already to the young man. The young man is trying to respond. And he can't quite do it, because it turns out, and only at this moment is it really revealed to him when he goes away sorrowing. He's always been a very good man, he's kept all those commandments. It turns out that he's not free. It turns out that his heart is elsewhere. He has been loved, and he wants to be completely loving in return, and he can't quite do it. Now, you may not be able to be put to quite that immediate challenge. You may. You may meet God one day, and he may say, give me everything. I've given you everything. That's your turn. You may do that. But I wonder if you will find yourselves, as you go through life, in a situation where you want to do something just and generous, when you want to make a big commitment, when you want to make a move, and the thing that's holding you back is something you didn't think you were so invested in, but it turns out you were. That a series of purely material considerations, of worldly ambitions, of concern about reputation, of concern about future security, have actually turned out to shackle you. And an enormous and beautiful thing that you could do in life isn't done, because somehow the whole deadly clutch of keeping stuff going in the world and the mortgages and all the rest of it held you back. You thought your heart could be given cleanly and clearly, and it turns out little bits of your heart had been siphoned off elsewhere. And you might want somehow to come free, you might want to get together, you might want to be released. And it may be that a continuous practice of gradually letting go, a continuous practice of giving slightly more whenever you're asked than you thought you could, whether it's of your time or your talents or your money, might actually mean that if there was a big decision to make one day, when you suddenly had to move forward, you would be a much freer person. I don't think this is about ticking boxes or keeping lists or justifying or proving yourself. I think it's entirely about love. It's about whether the stuff you have keeps you free to love or stops you from loving freely and fully. The question is, where is your heart? Where your treasure is, says Jesus, there your heart will be. That's, I think, the challenge that's offered us in this, the deepest question. Where is my treasure? And how freely can I give my heart? So, rather than evading it and saying, well, I don't think this one is addressed to me, we may just have to keep asking the question again and again. To whom is it addressed? To whom is it addressed? Perhaps it's not addressed to me now. Perhaps it will be addressed to me in a decade's time. I need to be open to hear it and always to know where my treasure and my heart really are, whether they are among the things that changes. That's just what you've just sung. You can't be secure. You need to be among the things that changes. You need to put your heart in that country of which that beautiful anthem was speaking, in order then to be fruitful and free Well, as always, I've tried to summarise these things in a sonnet, just to try and bring together some sense of our evasions, our difficulties, our need to return. I voiced this perhaps for the young man, perhaps for part of myself, perhaps for some of you. I'll close with this. Sell all you have. To whom exactly are you speaking, Lord? I take it you're not saying this to me, but just to this rich man, or to some saint like Francis, or to some community, the Benedictines maybe. Their restraint sustains so much, but I can't bear this word. I bought the deal, the whole consumer thing, signed up and filled my life with all this stuff, and now you come when I've got everything and tell me everything is not enough, but that one thing I lack, I cannot get. Sell everything I have? That's far too hard. I can't just sell it all. At least, not yet. To whom exactly are you speaking, Lord?